Among the sayings with which Heraclitus laid the foundation of the edifice of Western thought, there is one saying that reads, "The waking have one cosmos in common." It is one world shape in which they take part in common. By this is already expressed that what the late philosopher Plutarch, who preserved the fragment for us, pointed to in his interpretation: in sleep each turns away from the common cosmos and turns to something which belongs to him alone, something thus which he does not and cannot share with any other. The philosopher of Ephesus here makes manifest for the Occident the fundamental insight that the rhythmically regulated course of our daily existence does not mean an exchange of two states, but an exchange of two spheres in which we find ourselves by turns, and one of which he calls a cosmos. Heraclitus designates this one cosmos as a cosmos common to man. But that means something other and something greater than that we all dwell together in that sphere that we call the world, or that each of them is given just this sphere to perceive. The common is the sustaining category of Heraclitus. It enables him, despite man's want of understanding, so painfully suffered and so fiercely reproved by him, his want to grasp and confirm as a spiritual reality, or rather, I should repeat it, it enables him, Heraclitus, despite all, to grasp and confirm as a spiritual reality their togetherness, the full actuality of human being. When Heraclitus says of the logos, the meaning of being that dwells in the substance of the world, when he says of it that it is common, he thereby asserts that all men in the eternal originality of their genuine spoken intercourse with one another have a share in the consummation of this indwelling. This is also the case with the world shape, which belongs to the whole of the human race, the human cosmos, the common cosmos. the same meaning of existence, which holds away in the becoming of the words, the same genuineness forever renewing itself in the fire of oppositeness, is that which embodies itself in the world process. But this world, which Heraclitus understands as the world of man, never arises except out of the totality of the human race to which it belongs. Man contributes to the cosmic process with all that they are. Even in sleep, according to Heraclitus, no matter for each is submerged now in his private sphere, they are still, as individuals, so he says, workers and co-workers in the world happening. Passive workers. This means that there is no state in which the individual merely leads his own existence without contributing his part, just through living in this state, to the life of his human environment and of the world in general. But waking man, add in common to the world shape itself, which is just a human cosmos, recognizable as the cosmos of man as man. We associate with one another in the world, helping one another through the power of the Logos to grasp the world as a world order, without this ordering grasp, the world is not and cannot be a world. We can only do this, of course, if and insofar as we are truly awake. If we do not sleep while waking and spin dream-like illusions which we call their own insight, if we exist in common. One must follow that which is common. This great saying of Heraclitus only discloses its meaning to us when we have considered his teaching of the community of the Logos and the cosmos. Waking and sleeping are one of the pairs of opposites in which the unity of being fulfills itself. According to Heraclitus, swinging in them and bearing their tension. In each pair, each of the two opposites has its own place and its own right. But the effacement of the tension and of the mixture of the coupling of the opposites, the effacement of the tension Now let me say it in somewhat other form. Every effacement of the tension between the opposites and every mixture of them is evil. This is also the case with waking and sleeping. In sleep, there is no factual bond with others. Each dream, each man dreams of the others, but those of whom he dreams do not take part themselves in his dream. Conversely, that dream condition in which each is to himself alone must not penetrate into the common world of waking. Here and only here are we. Here as men awake, we may understand the Logos by understanding one another in our truth, through whose voice the Logos speaks. Here we are actively familiar with the cosmos through our cooperation, for it is a cosmos only to the degree in which we experience it together. Heraclitus places upon us the pure duty and responsibility of waking togetherness. He does not, of course, reject the dream, which has its place and its right, in that withdrawnness inaccessible to the we. But he does reject that dream-like refusal of the we, through whose illusion the cosmos and, let me say, through whose illusion the common cosmos is again and again broken asunder. The common day by day, is broken asunder. With his proclamation of the world shape assigned to the waking and of the meaning of being which is represented in it as the common that we must follow, Heraclitus has indicated to the spirit the task of showing itself awake in the human world. And that means the task of establishing in common a common reality. What that signifies in the history of the spirit can be made clear by the examples of the opposite. By two examples of the opposite. In the same age in which the Asia Minor Greek Heraclitus established the right and duty of the waking spirit, China received the decisive imprint of a teaching which was at once notably similar and notably dissimilar to his. This is the teaching of Tao, the way, which is in itself unconditional unity, yet bears, encompasses, and rhythmically regulates the alternation of the opposites and opposing processes, their correspondences and contradictions, where battles and where couplings. This happens in the world as in the spirit. For just as with Heraclitus, at general, so here, they both belong to one order. But, unlike Heraclitus, the opposites themselves do not stand here in Chinese, a doctrine of Taoism, do not stand here in the irreducible multiplicity of fire and water, day and night, life and death, as in Heraclitus. Rather, all these and all their like are only appearances and acts of the two primal substances, or the two primal essences, yin and yang. These essences manifest themselves as the feminine and the masculine, the dark and the light, the loose and the fast, the yielding and the advancing, and even as non-being and being, so that in a great book of Taoism, the Tao Te King, we find even the saying that being and non-being generate each other. What wisdom implies about the sphere of waking, and that, now let me add something. Here, in this doctrine of the opposites, in contrast to Heraclitus, the passive principle is accorded the proeminence because it is, in his opinion, the truly, the more truly effective one, the passive principle. What this implies about the sphere of waking and that of dreams is shown with the utmost clarity in a text of Chuang Tze, a thinker and poet of the 4th century, who considered himself a late-born disciple of Lao Tse, the master by then wholly inwoven in legend. Chuang Tze reports a dream and its secret. He speaks of himself in the third person. Chuang Tze, he writes, dreamed once that he was a butterfly. A butterfly fluttering hither and thither, without care and desire, unconscious of his existence as Chuang Tze. Suddenly he awoke, and he lay there again, the self-same Chuang Tze. Now he does not know. Is he a man who dreamed that he was a butterfly, or a butterfly who dreams that he is a man? This text is not isolated. Another Taoist book tells of a mythical realm of a realm at whose borders the play of the opposites grows lame. There is no difference between cold and hot, between night and day. the inhabitants who need neither food nor clothing sleep for 7 weeks without interruption. When they then awaken, they hold what they have dreamed to be real and what they now experience to be only apparent. In this teaching, obviously, no priority belongs to the waking existence. Indeed, if one of the two spheres were to be claimed as world, it might much more easily be that of dreams. And this just for the reason that the awakened are able to recognize it as dream, whereas the waker's circle of experience pretends to be simple reality without being able to support this claim. Logos and cosmos are not valid here, but the common also is not valid here. The human person in his withdrawal obtains the full measure of his allotted existence. In the same section in which the mythical realm is told of, we read how a frail servant was cruelly treated by his master, but dreamed night after night that he was a prince and lived in joy, and therefore he was also content with his lot by day. Whereas the opposite befell his master. And yet another story from the same section pictures Lao Tse as treating even madness with similar composure. If the whole world were insane except for you, he says to the complaining father of a mentally ill son, if the whole world were insane except for you, then it would be just you who would be the insane man. Thus it stands here concerning the antithetical spheres in the life of man. What we wakers hold to be a dream-like delusion is here valid as just as real as a waking world, indeed as more real. The other sphere stands ready to receive man, and even, I mean the dream, the sphere stands ready to receive man, and even comfortingly and graciously, but just not us, rather only each individual among us separately. We cannot enter it. It receives no we. Each of us dreams that he associates with others, but none of these others experiences this in itself. None enters the dream sphere with us. The claim of a special realm to be a world is that against which Heraclitus poses his elemental saying, one must follow that which is common. The other manifestation of the depths of the East is more far-reaching. It is a teaching of the oldest Upanishads, the teaching of dream sleep and deep sleep. The dream is generally regarded here as a first step the spirit of a person is depicted as he, after entering into the dream sleep, roams all over the whole world and gathers his building materials, which he splits up, that is, divides into their elementary parts, in order to build out of them, in his own light, what he can build. For, so we say, he is a creator. Verses clearly of still older origin than the prose teaching are quoted, in which it is said, that lower nest, the brave must guard it, the brave soul. He springs away, him or he, meaning the personal spirit. He springs away immortal from the nest. Immortal roves about where he wills, the golden spirit, the solitary wandering goose. In the state of dreams, he roves up and down and fashions for himself godlike all kinds of shapes. The sovereign freedom of the dream is praised more strongly here than in the Taoist text I quoted. All ties of the day are suspended. Self-glorious molder, the spirit fashions the whole world, subject to him as unresisting material. He needs for his work no other light than his own, and in divine power of transformation he clothes himself in shape after shape. And now the sovereign spirit ascends beyond the sphere of dreams. He finds no more satisfaction in the play of transformations. He gives up the last tie with the world, that of the images taken from it, and enters into the fully dreamless, imageless, desireless deep sleep. As in the air, continues the text, as in the air a falcon or an eagle, weary of flight, folding its pinions, prepares to spiral down, thus the essential spirit hurries to that sleeping state where it wishes no wish and beholds no dream. Drawn forth from all shapes by which it was related to the material of the world, even in dream, it has now attained a shapeless abiding in worldless being. Only when enclosed and hidden in this state is he, as the text says further on, beyond desire, untroubled by ills, free of anxiety. To all of which he was still exposed, in fact, in the dream world despite its absence of ties. He no longer experiences now what was separate from, separable from himself, for, quoting, there is no second outside of him. Another text, which stems out of the same oldest epoch of Upanishads, describes the same in another statement. When it is said, we read here, that when it is said that a man sleeps, by which it is just a deep sleep that is meant, when it is said that a man sleeps, he is united with being. He has entered into his self. Where one sees no ever, hears no ever, recognizes no ever, this is the fullness. We must pay close attention to what is said in this statement, which in the West has had far-reaching effects in our age. Sleep appears here as a way out of the sphere in which man is divided from the kernel of being, a way out of it to that in which he is united with it. The way leads beyond the freedom which unfolds in dreams to unity. This unity is that of the individual self with the self of being. They are in reality one single self. Where disunion in the waking world is when the great illusion. We become independent of a waking world in dream and yet remain still imprisoned in it. In deep sleep, we become free of it and thereby free of illusion, which alone divides the personal self from the self of being. An inference, to be sure, which was first conclusively drawn in later, more specifically, philosophical writings. According to them, the existence of man in the world is the existence of a world of appearance, a magical deception. But since the identity of a self can only be reached in an absolute solitude, just such as deep sleep, the existence between man and man is also ultimately only appearance and illusion. The saying, "Thou," or literally, wet art wow, wow art wet, which later ages have extended to the relation between man and man, is here solely, in the original teaching, solely intended for the relation between Brahman and Atman, the self of being and the self of a human person. Even though each man experiences the identity of all selves in deep sleep, he cannot establish it in the waking world, in the world of appearance. In one of the Upanishads that I have quoted, a being embraced by a beloved wife serves as a parable of unification. But considered as a fact of life, it is relegated to illusion. The man who adheres to the teaching of identity may, of course, when he says thou to a fellow man, say to himself in reference to the other, where are you yourself? For he believes the self of the other to be identical with his. But what the genuine saying of thou to the other in the reality of the common existence basically means, namely, the affirmation of the primarily deep otherness of the other, the affirmation of his otherness, which is accepted and loved by us just as this otherness, this is devalued and destroyed in spirit through just that identification. The teaching of identity not only stands in opposition to a belief in the true being of a common logos and a common cosmos, it also contradicts the arch reality of that out of which all community stems, human meeting. When taken seriously in the factual waking continuity of intercourse with one another, the ancient Indian "that art thou" becomes a postulate of an annihilation of the human person, one's own person as well as the other. For the person is through and through nothing other than uniqueness, and thus essentially other than all that is over against it. And even if that supposed universal self should remain in the ground of the I, it could no longer have intercourse, true intercourse with anyone. But we see in human existence, in the intercourse of man with man, of man with one another, that grows out of human existence, we see in it the chance for meeting between existing being and existing being. In this meeting, each of the two certainly does not say to himself, over there is you, but perhaps each says to the other, he can say to the other, I accept you as you are. Here first is uncurtailed existence. If I appeal to the philosophy of Heraclitus, shot through with contradiction as it appears, if I appeal to it against the uniformly soaring wisdom of the Orient, it is for the sake of a specific need of our time. I mean by this the confrontation of two points of view, the first of which values the collectivity above all else, whereas the second believes the meaning of existence to be disclosed or disclosable in the relation of the individual to his self. The first, which is usually called the Eastern, because it is today, especially at home in Eastern Europe, appears like a travesty of the ancient idea of a common way. The second, represented by Western philosophy, psychology, and literature, readily invokes the ancient Indian teaching and its offshoots. This latter I am discussing. And the reasons for this choice are weighty ones. The modern collectivism does in fact place the collectivity above all, but it does not ascribe to it the character of the absolute. It treats the absolute in general as an inadmissible fiction. The modern variety of individualism, in contrast, is inclined to understand the individual self, which the I finds in its depth, as the self simply, and thereby as the absolute. Despite all stress on the interest in the outer world or even a kind of cosmic sympathy, despite all reference to the all soul as we learn what is really meant, what unmistakably rules here is the tendency toward the primacy of the individual existence and toward its self-glorification. And this individualism is still more dangerous than collectivism, for the pretension of the false absolute is even more dangerous than the denial of the absolute. Let us call to mind, once more, the vital originality of the three basic concepts of Heraclitus. The concept of the common, of the logos, and of the cosmos. And starting from their originality, let us endeavor to penetrate into our situation. Heraclitus says of thinking that it is common to all, and he elucidates this by the statement that all men take part in thinking as well as in self-knowledge. The concreteness of his observation, which he preserves even in the highest abstractions, indicates that this does not mean the universally known fact that each of us possesses the capacity of thinking, but that when we know and think in accordance with the logos, we do so not in isolation, but in common. We blend all our particular knowing, and even in our knowledge of ourselves, one person helps the other. This communality in which we participate, living with one another, and acting on one another, this one must follow. Heraclitus always remained in accord with the thoroughly sensuous living speech of his time. For this reason, the Logos, even in its highest sublimation, does not cease to be for him the sensuous, meaningful word, the human talk which contains the meaning of the truth. Meaning can be in the word because it is in being. Thus it stirs deep in the soul which becomes aware of the meaning. It grows in it and develops out of it to a voice which speaks to fellow souls and is heard by them. Often, to be sure, without this hearing becoming a real receiving. And like the Logos, so also the Cosmos belongs to the common as to that in which men participate as in a common work. But it is common to them does not signify the likewise universally known fact that they find themselves together in the world. It signifies that their relationship to it is a common one. What is spoken of as the subjective side of our perception, however, is certainly not rendered uncertain by this insight of Heraclitus. For we can indeed show one another the things, describe for one another the things. Each can, supplementing the other, help him to have a world shape, a world. The great teachings from which we have proceeded, that of the Asia Minor bridge between East and West, and that of the Far East, resemble each other in both of them the spirit pleases, in both of them the spirit places its claim on the whole of a personal existence. And this claim is only seemingly separable from the teaching. They demand without remainder the teachings of the East and those Greek teachings of Asia Minor. They demand without remainder the life of him who hears it, the teaching. The early Upanishads point to the objective unification of the self of the soul and the self of being, which arises out of the cessation of consciousness in deep sleep. This unity, thus the claim is made here, shall be fulfilled afterwards by the waking, fully conscious, knowing person out of conscious existence through identifying his own self with that of the world. The teaching of the Tao points to the Tao of heaven, which governs the swinging cosmic opposites as to the primal image that man shall imitate and can imitate if he is aware of the Tao that dwells in himself, the Tao of man. He shall and can reconcile and vet with each other the conflicting opposites of existence without neutralizing them. For this teaching, too, no less than the whole human existence, the whole personal existence will do, the existence which does not interfere but radiates. Both teachings wish to lead man out of the entanglement in the common to the freedom of detachment, that of the Upanishads, into the solitude above the world, that of Taoism, into the solitude in the midst of the world. In contrast to both of them stands Heraclitus' teaching that bids one follow that which is common, that the existential claim of the spirit on the person is here actually of still greater weight. Just because, unlike those Indians, Heraclitus' teaching accepts the being of what is in all its manifoldness. Of what is in all its manifoldness, and knows no other harmony than that which arises out of attention. And just because, unlike those Chinese, he finds the meaning of being not in the ground of separateness, but in common to all, the existential claim is here so direct one. So direct one. Heraclitus' angry reprimand is aimed at the man who hears his word but does not yet truly understand it. It is not he himself that man, he, Heraclitus, that man must understand, he says, but the logos that is common to them all and that makes use of the man Heraclitus in order to enter between them into the spokenness. The Logos is certainly not alien to them. Indeed, as Heraclitus says, they continually have the closest intercourse with it, with the word, in that they always, in fact, take it in their mouth. And yet they live in discord with it because they always misuse the meaningful word and pervert its sense into nonsense. For it must be emphasized yet again, the Heraclitian concept of logos cannot be understood otherwise than from the primal establishment of a wedding between meaning and speech. It is hammered at us 3 and 4 times in the fragments that have been preserved. Logos is something that is to be heard, but is misheard, and that should not be heard, and that should be heard in the right way, as word with meaning, whereby its original concreteness, Logos is something that is to be heard, that is, in fact, misheard, and that should be heard in the right way as word with meaning. It seems incorrect to me to translate logos in oversimplified fashion as just meaning, whereby its original concreteness is given up. Nor can I agree when, from an especially competent quarter, it is interpreted not with us, rather with the logos in yourselves. Must you agree? So, must you agree? Whereas Heraclitus simply says, do not listen to me, but to the logos. Each soul does, of course, have the logos deep in itself, but the logos does not attain to its fullness in us, not in us, but rather between us. For it means the eternal chance for speech to become true between men. Therefore, it is common to them. To man as man, belongs the ever-renewed event of the entrance of meaning into the living world. Heraclitus demands of a human person that he preserve this occurrence in life in such a way that it can legitimately take part in the reality of the common logos in a genuine service of meaning. Out of such persons alone can circles be formed that follow the logos. These are those who genuinely think with one another because they genuinely talk to one another. All men, according to Heraclitus, have an essential share in self-knowledge and sensible thinking. That is naturally something that each person can only fulfill personally. But while they fulfill it, and insofar as they fulfill it, they take part in the self-knowledge of man and in his common thinking. And again, no matter how numberless always are the people of whom Heraclitus says that they neither understand how to listen nor how to talk, nevertheless, no aberration, no perversion of thought can undermine the fact that the communal guarding of meaning, such communal guarding of meaning is affected existentially. But there is also in the Heraclitan idea of a common cosmos an existential